Carolina game. Three are left in the regular season, including a battle with Minnesota. The Packers may have to win all of their remaining games in order to make the playoffs. Meanwhile, the Bears ended a five-game losing streak with a 33-7 win over the Bengals. Now, the forecast from the National Weather Service. Additional snowfall this afternoon. Could see an inch or two. A high today around 34. That's precisely the normal for this time of year. Then for tonight, cloudy, blustery, a low around 14. Mostly sunny tomorrow, a high of just 18. Wind chills of 5 below to 5 above. Expanded forecast includes a slight moderation in temperature. Wednesday's high near 26, Thursday's high 29, a slight chance of some additional snowfall for Wednesday and Thursday. Right now, cloudy skies, a temperature reading of 26. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Before we get to our new interview with Wisconsin author Michael Perry, I want to play for you an excerpt that comes from a previous interview recorded with Michael Perry 5 years ago upon the publication of his book called Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. I chose this excerpt because for those of you that maybe don't know too much about Michael Perry, there's a moment early on in the interview where Michael Perry kind of sketches out, in a sense, who he is and where he comes from, before then beginning to talk about his neighbor named Tom, who has lived in the same farmhouse for 82 years at the time of the writing of this book. We'll get to Michael Perry's new book very shortly. So here's a portion of that interview again from 5 years ago with author Michael Perry. Maybe ahead of us talking specifically about this book, for the sake of someone who didn't hear either of those first two interviews or for whatever reason doesn't know your story, maybe you could give them just a brief sketch of sort of where you come from and where you've ended up, which is not that far from where you come from, actually. But sure. Maybe just kind of a sense of where life has taken you.
Well, I was born in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin, and my dad at that time worked in the paper mills over near or in Port Edwards, and we lived in a little tar paper, I think it was a log cabin originally. I love that because I can say I started out in a log cabin, but I think it was tar papered over, a little house in Nakusa, Wisconsin. And then when I was two, my dad bought a farm up north of New Auburn, Wisconsin, and probably by today's terms about 40 minutes north of Eau Claire, to give people an idea. And my mom, all her life, had said they were both city kids, and my mom had said she didn't care who she married as long as she didn't marry a farmer. So she married my dad, a city kid with a chemistry degree working at the paper mills, and 2 years into the marriage, she sold everything and bought a farm. So I wound up being raised on a dairy farm and grew up milking cows and cleaning calf pens, and dad also had a flock of sheep and baling hay and doing field work. And then at the age of 16, I started working summers on a ranch out in Wyoming, a working beef and hay ranch, and did branding and Roundup. And I continued there every summer for 5 years, so that's how I put myself through college. And I have a nursing degree. I have a bachelor's degree in nursing. And one of my longstanding jokes is I was the only cowboy in all of Wyoming who was putting himself through nursing school, which led to some interesting discussions around the old Brandon fire. But I got out of nursing school, worked as a nurse for a while, enjoyed it, but very accidentally started writing and got interested kind of in a sideways manner, and I wrote a little essay, and it got published in the local regional magazine, and I became very taken with the idea, and I started going to poetry readings, and I went to the library and checked out a book on how to be a writer, and I just started writing like crazy and sending stuff every which way, and 20 years later, that's basically what I'm still doing, sending things out every which way and trying to put a living together. So I do a little bit of everything, mostly writing for magazines, and this is my fifth or sixth book for Harper Collins, depending on how you count them, and I have a band, and we go around, and I do a lot of speaking and that sort of thing, and then we live on a little farm near Fall Creek, Wisconsin, and I'm on the volunteer fire department there, and we raise chickens and sometimes pigs. I took a year off the pigs this year because I'm going to be on book tour, but just I get to travel around the country a lot, but at the end of the day, I'm happiest right here out in the country in Wisconsin.
Hmm. At one point in this new book, Visiting Tom, you write, "We live on a farm, but I am not a farmer."
Well, the reason for that, and I get into it in a little more detail in the book, but obviously for means of promotion, which is part of this business, I'm often touted as this writer slash farmer, and I always think of the farmers who raised me. I think of my brother, who right now as we speak, you know, is looking at his cornfields in the middle of this drought and wondering about next year, and here I am. I'm a guy who, there's no getting around it, I made my living by writing and performing, and I have a little patch of corn and a little patch of oats, and I have some pigs sometimes and some chickens. But if I come home from book tour and my pigs are all dead, that's a bad weekend. But if my brother loses all his corn, you know, then he actually put his whole deal on the line there. So yeah, I'm always careful not to overdo the farmer thing too much.
Right.
But I really do. I mean, I still bale hay with my neighbor, and you know, we do some stuff, a little bit of farm work, put up our own firewood, that kind of stuff.
But you say if you are absent from the operation upwards of 100 days per annum, you dare not designate yourself a farmer.
No. Plus, when I go down to the feed mill to get feed, all they would have to do is ask to look at the palms of my hands, and the discussion would be over pretty quickly. I have the hands of a typist, not a farmer.
Actually, one of the moments in this book that I really deeply appreciate, and I want to just touch briefly on this, and let's explore it in more detail a little bit later. But the framework of the book is your encounters with this neighbor of yours, Tom Hartwig. And each chapter of the book begins with a vignette, something about him or about his particular farm or something about his life. And I especially love how you open up the second chapter of the book talking about Tom Hartwig's very crowded workshop. I mean, which is just loaded wall to wall and floor to ceiling with all kinds of stuff, and I mean, it's an amazing amount of equipment, machinery, and tools, and so on that fill up this shed, and I so love the way you appreciate this and what it represents in a way that sails right over the heads of most of us city slickers. If you'll permit me to read one paragraph, and then I'd love you to kind of expound on it a little bit. You write at the end of this long, interesting description of this workshop, "For now, though, you backtrack through the maze and simply run your eyes around the place. You wonder what calculus might quantify the cumulative toil represented by every hand-worn tool, every besmudged Folgers can brimmed with bolts, every belt and pulley, every project set aside for the moment how many years ago. And this is only what is visible and tangible. What of every project in and out of here over the decades, right through today? Somewhere right this instant, a hand-turned axle bears the weight of a loaded hay wagon. A refurbished bushing vibrates in the bowels of a $250,000 combine. The weld bead on a corn picker slowly rusts in the blackberry canes out behind some barn somewhere. In stillness, the place echoes with work." I mean, a lot of us would look at that and just see a kind of a dirty, junky-looking shed, and you see, in a sense, an amazing monument to work, and particularly the work that has been done by this neighbor of yours.
Yeah, I think a couple of things come to mind, and one is you mentioned city slickers, and that's one thing I'm always careful about, because sometimes I feel like there's this false dichotomy thrown up that, you know, I'm the country mouse explaining things to the city mouse, and I always try to be careful of that, because the city mouse has a lot to teach the country mouse too. And I'm thinking in particular of a lot of my friends in more urban settings who are finding, you know, and I write about a guy actually later in the book who's living in a suburban setting but raising quite literally tons of food in his backyard and that kind of thing. But there is something about the cumulative work and looking around that place, and I get into it a little more in depth in the book, that I was raised around folks like Tom, and naturally that's part of what drew me to write about him, is some sense of preservation or trying to cheat time a little bit. But you do see all this accumulation, and it is, perception is funny. I love to study that stuff and write the paragraph that you just kindly read, and of course it takes me forever, and 57 drafts, and I'm trying, how can I keep this interesting even if I'm just talking about a messy shop? And it's, perception is funny, because I love the poetry of all those words that, you know, aren't ones I thought of, but just the words that describe a shop or talking about a particular type of tool, and so that's all fun. But then where I'm getting to here with the idea of perception is, I lovingly craft this description of Tom's shop, and at one point I went over the description with Tom, and he said, you know, I talked about the accumulation of toil and the echo of labor, and he said, oh, to me it just looks like I'm going to wind up on one of them hoarder shows. So he's much less romantic about it, but and you know what? I'm not sure I can articulate this well. I do much better typing with lots of revision. I'm not so hot on the fly, but I'm a guy, it's been a long-term source of some humor, but also genuine embarrassment, that I'm a blue-collar guy with farmer, logger, trucker roots. Those are the folks who raised me, and I can speak the language, and I can walk like them and talk like them, and I'm very comfortable down at the feed mill. But the truth is, I could no more tear apart and put back together successfully an engine than I could be a ballerina. And I lack very basic mechanical skills, and I wouldn't be a good full-time farmer. And yet, because of where I was raised and because I do like to write, I do have this ability to immerse myself in that world and then try to convey it to folks who may not be familiar with it. And I always feel a little bit of redemption there, where, you know, perhaps I can convey to another group just why a dark, dingy, cluttered shop like that is so meaningful to some of us. I don't know. I hope.
We're speaking with Michael Perry, and we are talking about his latest book called Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. This is probably as good a time as any for you to kind of explain how this book came into being. And it's kind of interesting dual stories that sort of form the spine of the book itself. Was this an idea entirely of your own making, and did anything in particular sort of create that light bulb above your head that that this story of your life and your neighbors would be a wonderful vehicle for yet another great book.
Well, the parts of the book that look like it was well thought out and planned, they just happened. So there, you know, there's a parallel story, which I'll get into in a minute. That was completely not on the radar when I started. But initially, I mean, my first thing is that I make no bones about the fact that I'm, you know, I've got two little girls and we're a self-employed family, and so I'm trying to make a living. So I'm always looking for, you know, what can I write about that I think will attract some interest. But then it has to interest me, and it has to be something I care about. And the first time I went to meet Tom and his wife, it was as a guest of my eventually to-be wife. And I have the scene in the book about the first time I stepped into their kitchen, and I was swept by such a feeling of comfort and recognition. I'd never met these people, but I knew exactly where I was and how to comport myself. And so and then Tom is just one of those, I think I've variously described him. In one case, I described him as a roughneck polymath. He's just one of those guys that he can do everything. And he's not just, this is not just him doing foxfire tricks. And, you know, how, he talks in there about how to make oxen yokes. And he talks about driving his team of oxen. But this is a guy who also will talk to you about the latest automotive technology. I mean, he is up to date on current events as well. And I thought it would be wonderful to try and accurately portray him. And so then once I had that idea, the other thing that I wanted to avoid was I didn't want this to turn into one of those Tom is my mentor, I'm his acolyte, I study at his feet, and, you know, he makes cannons and shoots them. And for a little while I thought, you know, I should do a book where he and I will build a cannon together. And perhaps that would be a better book and maybe it would sell more copies. But I just realized there would be an artifice to that I really couldn't get around. And so the ultimate point of the book is, what can you learn from a guy who's simply your neighbor? And we have a little bit of a personal connection because my wife grew up in this area and she used to work for Tom. But in general, he's just my neighbor. We're not best buddies. We don't see each other a lot. I generally go over there when I need something cut, bent, or welded. And sometimes you go over for dinner and take a dozen eggs or some of our pork chops. But I really just wanted to write a book about what you can learn in passing from someone. And in his case, as it turns out, quite a lot. And then the other part of the story is that he lived on a very secluded farm all of his life. He's been there 82 years. And until middle age, it was very secluded. You couldn't really see any other roads, no one else, and he had a creek running through his barnyard. And then in the mid-60s, the U.S. government put an interstate, literally aimed it at his barn, took it right through his yard. And in the book I write about, he was able to get him to move it enough so they didn't knock his barn over, but that was the only battle he won. And so he now, this guy, went from living his entire life in this quiet, isolated farmstead with a creek gurgling just down from the barn to now he has over 8 million vehicles a year going through his front yard, over 20,000 a day. And I'm fascinated by how he can go on a wonderful rant about the whole thing, quite entertaining. But he's also got equanimity. He's lived a full and happy life. He hasn't let this monstrous intrusion distract him from being engaged. And so that was, as I began to get into the book deeper, I realized that's what I was really shooting for here, is exploring that idea of equanimity.
Hmm.
And then, of course, I write in there that as I'm working on the book, we live at the top of a dead-end road that's on a very steep hill. And for 100 years, people have been making the hill by getting a run at it, as we say around here. And the local highway commissioner decided to redesign the intersection based on what he termed safety improvements, and I submitted that his safety improvements would actually make it so we couldn't get up our hill and create more hazards. And in a nutshell, he and I disagreed. We continue to disagree, but I write about how we handled that in the book, and that my little mini quandary with this tiny little intersection, you know, we're talking 30 feet of blacktop and gravel here, as compared to Tom's 8 million vehicles a year, it became kind of this comic backdrop to the much larger battle that Tom had to fight.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the fact that you first met Tom and Arlene Hartwig through your wife. They were already friends of hers, and you talked about this, what you call in the book, this gut-level sense of comfort that you felt the moment you crossed the threshold of their home. I mean, it's like it was home in this amazing way. But you go on to talk about something else about that night, when you met the Hartwigs for the first time. This was not only about meeting them and liking them so much, but this was also about learning something or about your wife or seeing something about her very clearly for the very first time. Talk about that part of this special night.
Well, when I walked through the door with her, I went into this kitchen that was, you know, it's not all shiny and spit polished in there. Some dishes stacked, and there's a ice cream bucket full of, well, now you would call it compost. From my day, we just called it the food garbage. And, you know, there's stuff, magazines and books and flyers and junk mail stacked around, and there's a dog on the floor and a gigantic cat in the chair. And but what I meant about the comfort is you walk into a kitchen like that and you realize that you don't have to take your boots off. You don't have to call ahead so that they've got quick time to clean it up. They're just interested in seeing you and visiting. And so that was the, you know, the worn floor that you could wear your boots on. And so there was that immediate physical comfort and recognition of these were the kitchens I walked into when my dad would take me, and I would be sitting there on his knee. But then as we talked and I got to know them, and they reminded me even more of the people I grew up with, and the fact that they're just hardworking, quiet people. The fact that my wife had chosen to take me to meet these people and hadn't taken me there right away. She had waited until she knew me a little bit and had made it clear that these people meant a lot to her. When I realized that these were the kind of people she valued, that I remember that night, something clicked in me where I went, well, if she values these kind of people, that tells me a lot about her. And I think that's probably the pivot that you're referring to.
I sure am. You write, as I watched her laugh and trade stories, I saw signs of an old soul, a person who paid her respects and paid them to the sort of people much of the world passes by at top speed. Prior to our night in the Hartwigs' kitchen, I saw Annalise as beautiful, desirable, smart, and strong, more than enough, in other words, and easily more than I had earned. But as I watched how she honored Tom and Arlene with nothing fancier than honest talk and clear laughter, I began to realize I had found a person perfectly and unpretentiously matched to the roughneck kitchen of my dreams.
Pretty much.
Well, and I love the point you're making there, because I think a lot of us don't stop to think about that one of the ways we get to know each other and really get a sense of the character of each other is the way people treat other people and the people that a given person values and wants in their life and appreciates. I mean, I'm not sure there's anything that says more about us and what is important to us than what people are important to us.
Yeah, I won't elaborate, because I think that little section said exactly what I mean. I would only add I've just then spent the rest of our relationship trying to continue to earn her attention.
Michael Perry, in a conversation from 5 years ago, talking about his book, Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. And now to his newest book, a wonderful book called Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy. This is a book in which Michael Perry discusses, of all things, a 16th century philosopher by the name of Michel de Montaigne, who lived from 1533 to 1592, one of the most important philosophers of the French Renaissance, and one of the very first people in history to gain fame from writing and publishing what we now call the personal essay, and making very intriguing observations about life and the world that remain remarkably relevant to this very day. Here is our conversation about this new book, again called Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy. Explain to our listeners your own introduction to this early essayist, how you first came across him and his writing.
Well, I had a kidney stone.
That's the short answer, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm a self-employed writer, and this came at a time when I was not sure where the next mortgage payment was coming from, and I had a kidney stone, and I was self-insured, and paying for everything out of my own pocket, and I was in the ER and wondering how I was going to pay for this. And at the time, I was writing for a men's health magazine, and I thought, well, maybe I could write an essay about kidney stones and cover my deductible. And so I actually called my editor from the ER, Gurney, and got approval. And so I started taking notes about my kidney stone experience right up until the time about 2 weeks later when, as they put it in the book, I peed out the devil's own gobstopper. And but then, of course, I turned to do more formal research. And as part of that research, I started reading medical journal articles about renal calculi. And this name Montaigne kept coming up. And so I started to look into it. And what it was this 16th century nobleman who had written essays about being afflicted with kidney stones. And so when I finished the article, I started reading more and more of him, and that was my official introduction.
And you now, over the course of time, have not only read a great deal of his works directly, but you've also read a whole lot of books about him. Help us understand where he stands sort of in the history of essay writing and his importance, his significance.
Well, it's widely agreed, although not completely agreed. Nobody agrees on everything anymore, but it's pretty widely accepted that he invented the personal essay. And by that, I mean, he would write about anything. He was very learned. He was a nobleman. He was born to great privilege, retired at the age of 38 to sit in his castle tower and meditate. And when he found out he wasn't very good at just thinking, he started scribbling down his thoughts to keep track of them. And that then became the essays. But he would write about anything. He would write about poetry. He would write about, he was always name-checking people like Lucretius and Seneca. But then he would turn right around and write an entire essay about his thumb. He wrote pieces about marriage. He wrote pieces about flatulence. He really would go just about anywhere.
And I think what's really intriguing is the mixture of elements in his writing, including what seems to be sort of a flavor of self-deprecation and a little bit of a spirit of hesitancy. That is, he writes with beautiful flow about, as you have already said, a wide array of different topics and subjects, and yet in so much of what he writes, you tell us, there is this air of, I'm not fully sure of this, but I think maybe this is true. Sort of a spirit of humility that seems to flavor a lot of what he writes. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I think I somewhere in the book I said one of the reasons I love what he does is that he's willing to say I could be wrong. He's always willing to offer a caveat, and as such, I dedicated the book to those who approach conversation with something less than a steamroller. And I think, you know, I speaking personally at this particular juncture in our history, you have a great hunger to discuss something with someone and perhaps not even be in agreement, but to attempt to learn something from the other person as opposed to whack them into submission. And yes, he was very much certainly into some equivocation, but also just open to different ideas and open to the idea that he would lay out what he thought about something, but then say, but I could be wrong. And as I said, even in writing this book, I'm trying to operate under the auspices of exploration rather than declaration.
Hmm. Something else you say about him in terms of his relationship to you and the kind of writing that you have done for many, many years. You say at one point, because I want to live as a freelance writer and a freelance writer must produce copy, I offer things in print I would never offer in conversation. And then you quote Montaigne as saying, amusing notion, many things that I would not want to tell anyone, I tell the public. And for my most secret knowledge and thoughts, I send my most faithful friends
to a bookseller's shop. Can you tell us a little bit more about this really intriguing, what is it, maybe a paradox in Montaigne and in your life as well?
Yeah, when Montaigne started out, and again, I am not an academic, and so many people have worked so hard and so long to unpack what he did, and I operate with respect, out of respect to them, and make sure to nod to them in the book. But from my amateur perspective, I would say that he started out as a Stoic, both little s and big S, and his goal was to learn how to die a noble death. And then he had a kidney stone, and he realized, well, some things physical just take away your nobility no matter how hard you try. And he was living in the age before Percocet and Toradol medications. But he wanted to be this Stoic person, and yet he would reveal all these things about himself, including his weaknesses. And I relate to that, and that I'm a Stoic Scandinavian. I don't want to talk about my feelings, and you can't make me. But I wound up in a profession where I have to write things and tell them if I'm going to pay for the kids' braces. And so at 3 a.m., you're under the duress of not finishing a piece and not knowing how you're going to get someone to publish what you write, and the kids are asleep and you're not sure how you're going to take care of them. And so you open up your chest or a vein and you share something you would never, ever share in person just because you need something to write about. And then what happens, as I describe in the book, is that you're at a very nice literary event signing books, and some gentleman comes up and asks about a very personal condition you have. And I looked at the guy and just said, how do you know that? And he said, well, you wrote about it. And my response was, well, I shouldn't have.
And yet you did. And we're glad
and yet
you did.
I did.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling author Michael Perry, whose latest book is called Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy. This is his exploration of the fascinating writings of 16th century essayist Michel de Montaigne. It's so intriguing the way in which his writing seems to touch on so many themes that have been important in your life and in your work, including something that I don't remember reading about in so many words in your previous books, and yet in some ways your life is all about this, a term that we hear in the second chapter called roughnecked intersectionality. And explain this term, and in particular the way in which it is in so many respects kind of an embodiment of who you are, especially as a writer.
Well, probably the best way to describe it is from the opening of the essay, which I describe. I say that Michel de Montaigne died in 1592 and was therefore unable to attend the Augusta Bean and Bacon Days Demolition Derby in 2013, which is a shame because my daughters and I attended and we had a wonderful time. Then I go on to explain that 2 days prior to that, we also attended the Shakespeare Festival at a university in Minnesota. And from there, I just talk about the idea that we seem to want to put ourselves into these divided camps, that you're either into the Demolition Derby or you're into the Shakespeare plays. And Montaigne was the kind of guy who encourages me to live in both worlds, that talk about trying to show my daughters that cultural consumption can be enjoyed on a sliding scale, including down there where it's greasy. And Montaigne really helped me explore that. And I don't even like the terms high culture and low culture because you're applying a designation that perhaps you're not qualified to apply, and you're also implying things. But for the sake of shorthand, I enjoy both worlds. And Montaigne really helped me explore that.
Mm. Later in this chapter, you offer some really, I think, intriguing observations about the world of the internet in which we now all live and are with which we're trying to contend. And I think your observations are absolutely right on target. You say at one point, the internet and social media in particular is the ultimate intersectionality catalyst voices previously unheard are amplified. And later in that same paragraph, you say, we find ourselves interwoven in unexpected ways. You can't hide like you used to. I really appreciate the way in which you are honest about the issues of the internet and social media that in some ways tend to stoke the passions that tend to divide us, and yet you clearly also see the potential there in terms of the way in which we can come to understand the way we are connected with each other, even with people who at a glance seem to be utterly different from us. Can you say more about that?
Yes, I certainly go to great lengths to make it clear that I understand the horrific cesspool of commentary that is out there, and certainly what it is like, for instance, to be a woman on the internet and say something. I talk about a sociologist that I've come to know through the internet and the abuse that she endures for making statements and for sharing her research. And yet what I cherish about her is that here is an academic sharing research on Twitter in such a way that a knucklehead like me stumbles across it, and it changes my thinking. And so I'm trying to explore that idea that while there's great horror out there on the internet, and I don't in any way mean to minimize that, on the other hand, it has allowed a guy like me writing in a little room over a garage in rural Wisconsin to strike up a dialogue with a Cuban-American writer living in Brooklyn, and has taught me some things that I think I needed to learn. And it has put me in dialogue with, as I said, a woman who's a sociologist at a university I've never attended, and yet I can learn from her, and I can also vicariously experience what her life experience is like. And when filtered properly, I think, hope, that social media does have some power to generate empathy.
And I love how you talk about how so often in these kind of arenas, such as in social media, there is this real tendency for most of us to be, in your words, ferociously impatient. And there is this hunger to respond immediately and in the clearest of terms. And you say, I would so much rather ask questions and not be assigned a side. You really appreciate each and every opportunity that you have to engage with people who see the world differently than you do. You want to experience what somebody calls the tension of difference. And again, this is intriguing because in some respects, it's a little bit at odds with who you are in terms of the way you tend to interact with the people in your world, at least, you know, in spoken conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I keep, matter of fact, even during this discussion that we're having, I'm enjoying the fact that you're doing a great job of pronouncing the name of the gentleman in question properly, whereas I'm from Chippewa County, Wisconsin, and I say Montaigne, and I talk about that in the book, about how you should pronounce the name. And so I do find myself often in unexpected conversational situations, whether it's online or whether it's down at the feed mill. And in the end, I just keep coming back to the idea that Montaigne taught me that, well, maybe I can learn something from this conversation, and I'm going to do my best. I don't mean to say that we can all just be, you know, at some point you do have to make a decision. At some point you do have to take a stand. But yes, social media has sort of created this environment where you're expected in a split second to favorite something or like something or tear something down, whereas in real life, often things move more slowly than that or should.
Hmm. I know that probably one chapter of the book that I'm guessing has generated an exceptional amount of attention is the fourth chapter of the book titled Shame, in which, among other things, you talk about sex. Although it's interesting, you take nine pages, pages 88, 81 to page 90, to
basically talking about sex. You don't really start talking about it till page 91, and but it springs out of a sort of a deep-seated reticence for you and for others in your family, and I wonder if you could just say a word about the extent to which Michel de Montaigne has written about this and how his attitudes reflect your own.
Well, he was much less reticent than I. He wrote about it in great detail and in many different facets of sex. He was happy to talk about impotence and performance, and he saw it definitely as a source of great humor. He was very good at making fun of men and how they swagger about, but in the end they were these rather weak and delicate creatures. Scholars have noted that his attitudes about women and sex were interesting, and that in some ways he was classically male in his attitudes towards women. But on the other hand, he was one of the first to say that not only did women enjoy sex, but they had a right to. And but as far as me, it's still a tough one for me, and in part just because my mom's still alive. And I said in the book, I'm 51 years old, and I still care what my mom thinks, thank goodness. on the other hand, I kind of wish that I'd had someone around me like Montaigne a little earlier in my life. It might have saved not only me, but a few people around me a little bit of difficulty.
By the way, I also really appreciated, because it so resonated with me, when it comes to, in general, bodily functions. You say, my circumspection in sexual matters was a full-on burlesque compared to my reticence regarding bodily functions. This is odd in that, as a farm boy, I spent my formative years standing, sometimes barefooted, in manure. And as a nurse, I dealt with every imaginable secretion and excretion in straightforward fashion. But lightly, socially, it just wasn't done. And the hangover continues.
This is funny because we're circling back in real time to something you already mentioned. I'm remembering some of the things I wrote in this book and going, oh my gosh, what was I thinking?
Well, and what's interesting in this chapter, you know, as amusing as much of it is, the really secret, the central matter is that of shame. And you say, I'm attempting to refine my understanding of shame, its power, and its paralysis. And you actually end up touching on, among other things, the fact that you very, very consciously have avoided alcohol all of your life. Even though you live in a place and work side by side with all kinds of people where it's a regular presence in their life, but this is important to you.
Yeah, it started out as a religious thing, the way that I was raised, and then that doesn't preclude it for most folks. And in my teen years, I never started, and I think because I said I wasn't interested from an early age, I really didn't get pressured that much, although where I came from, certainly there was a lot of heavy and underage drinking happening. And then even after I left the church that I was in, I just didn't drink, wasn't on any big crusade. And then I think I wrote in the book about there was a time when I was dealing with some fairly severe depression where one day I decided I just wanted to try drinking just so that I could have a day off from the worry and the concern. And while I was having that thought, I was walking upstairs to my little office where I wrote in the house where I lived at the time. And when I stepped into that office, it was ankle deep in candy and ho-ho wrappers and empty coffee cups. And I hadn't been out of the house for about a week. And I thought, you know, I think you probably shouldn't start.
I also really appreciate the candor of the next chapter called Marriage, in which you spell out all kinds of reasons why, in your words, life with me can be miserable. You eventually begin exploring the matter of your kind of emotional state and the fact that there are things about you emotionally and mentally that are in some respects we might say fragile, and that you are prone to swings of mood that you're probably still trying to sort of sort out. And even as you talk about, for instance, the way in which sometimes you seem to sag into a state of depression, that you're very reluctant to necessarily assign that term to yourself or talk about it, not out of embarrassment, but I think for other reasons. Can you talk for a moment about this reality in your life and the great care with which you explore it and talk about it?
Well, the reticence there comes from a couple of things. One is just that blue-collar stoicism that I spring from. The other is being surrounded by people who really are struggling with profound challenges, whether they're economic, whether they're personal. And so that when I am feeling depressed, I don't feel like I have really much cause to complain about it when there are so many others suffering so much more. On the other hand, I've also watched as this predisposition to keep things quiet and to tough it out has injured folks. And so that's why I open up about it a little bit. And I talk about my brother, the logger, who nobody's tougher than he is. But we both share some anxiety and depression issues, him to a much greater degree. And I just felt like that was my little contribution to saying, hey, these things are there's something that we do need to examine. We do need to take them seriously, and we do need to talk about them, even if they do come at us in varying degrees.
Right. I think that's one of the things I especially appreciate about the way you talk about this, because for you it seems as though you live in a kind of a zone of gray. And it's maybe not always that we hear from those particular voices. We tend to talk about depression and think about it in its most acute sense. And there's probably many, many more people who experience shades of depression the way that you do. For instance, one point you write, I've never felt suicidal. I've had plenty of stretches where I wouldn't have minded if the bus hit me, but I've never gone looking for the bus. I assume this is a privilege of chemistry, because it is for damn sure isn't character. But I mean, the main point there being that it's important for us to explore things like that, like what it feels to be mildly depressed, or to be in a marriage that's been going for a while and you're just on the edge of wondering, is this something that needs to be refreshed? I mean, that's a common state, but we don't talk about it enough or explore it enough, and it seems like that's something you do so very, very well.
Well, that's kind of you, and I think also there's a little bit of self-therapy happening there. That's tricky, because when you're writing a memoir, as this is, a writer named Darcy Frey told me one time, if you're going to use the pronoun I, it had better be transparent. And so if I'm going to write about myself, I better do it in such a way that I hope that the reader can perhaps look through that and see something useful for themselves.
Well, we certainly need more of that in this world in which we live. And I trust that anybody who reads your book will, just by following your example, maybe live a little more thoughtfully and a little more reflectively. I know I derive so much pleasure from reading your newest book, Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy, published by HarperCollins, the author Michael Perry. Michael Perry, thank you so much for giving the world yet another fascinating and thought-provoking book, and thank you for being part of the morning show today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Bandy X. Lee, the editor of a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, gathers together the thoughts